From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, what makes Bob Donovan run? We'll get some interesting insight into the outspoken alderman.
I thought that with somebody that high profile, it's worth taking a look into what makes them tick, what they're really all about, what they really want.
Later, how Milwaukee business news has changed in 30 years as the Business Journal marks an anniversary, how the debates over mining-related laws in Wisconsin are emblematic of a global trend, and why the leader of the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music was eager to leave Florida.
Northerners often have a stronger value on the arts is because it's a part of the education system. It's a part of the churches that are up here. So I was looking forward to getting back north again.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us today. When it comes to developments in city government in Milwaukee, there's one thing you can almost guarantee, a public comment or a news release by Alderman Bob Donovan. Donovan represents the 8th District on Milwaukee's south side, and he's often a thorn in the side of a mayor and common council that are generally pretty closely aligned. In fact, his outspokenness on many issues are such that a movement has sprung up to draft Bob Donovan to run in the next mayoral election. Donovan's the subject of an in-depth profile in the November issue of Milwaukee Magazine. Reporter Larry Sandler joins us to offer some insights into a political figure who he got to spend quite a lot of time with. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mitch. Good to be back here.
There are many, many contradictory opinions, I guess, about Alderman Donovan that you write about in this article. But let's start with an issue that people seem to be in agreement around, and that is why he seems to enjoy such strong support in his district. Talk about Bob Donovan's approach to constituent service.
Yeah, Donovan is very much into constituent service. He came up from the ranks of being a community activist. So he came from the neighborhood. He's very close to the neighborhood and to the people there. And so he does a number of things with constituent service. One is that during the warmer months, he walks through the district, through one particular part of the district, one neighborhood, twice a week. And he goes with staff, public works staff, neighborhood services staff, somebody from the police department, somebody from one of the community groups, and they go together through the neighborhood and look for problems, look for issues, talk to constituents. I went along with him on one of these walks, and it's very interesting to see. I mean, he goes after all of these little things. Here's somebody whose paint is peeling. Here's a place where, you know, maybe a streetlight is out. And he finds all these little things that by themselves aren't very much, but together he sees them as adding up to the quality of life. And then meanwhile, like all aldermen, he gets a lot of calls. He gets a lot of calls from constituents who want his help with one thing or another, navigating the city bureaucracy, getting help with their garbage pickup or getting their street repaired or whatever. And he's very responsive to that.
And you're right that he gets calls from people that are actually not in his district.
Yes. And this is a function of the high citywide profile that he's maintained, you know, much more so than a lot of other aldermen. His name is known throughout the city, not necessarily liked in all corners of the city, but he has his constituency, and his constituency is not limited to his district. And so there are some people from outside his district who call him, particularly his aide told me, after he's put out a news release or had a news conference, raises his profile a little more, he gets a few more calls from outside his district.
Well, let's go back to the beginning of this article for you. What were you hoping to do with this profile? Why was Bob Donovan's story compelling enough that you wanted to fill in some blanks, if you will?
Well, he is sort of a unique figure on the Milwaukee Common Council in many ways. One is that while he is certainly not the only conservative or not the only critic of Mayor Barrett, he is the most vocal. He is the most visible. He holds a lot of news conferences, issues a lot of news releases, grants a lot of interviews. You see him on TV all the time, so much so that people start to see him as a possible challenger to Mayor Barrett. He's never pulled the plug. He might not, but people talk about it. So I thought that with somebody that high profile, it's worth taking a look into what makes them tick, what they're really all about, what they really want.
You write about his political leanings, including the detail that he ran for office early in his career twice as a Republican, which seemed to surprise some of your other sources for this story.
It did. It did. And this is something that, you know, some Milwaukee old-timers, you know, particularly from the South Side, might remember, but a lot of people have forgotten. And when he was a young man, he did run for office twice for the Assembly as a Republican, got soundly defeated because this is a pretty solidly Democratic city. But it was interesting to me that when I asked him how he got into politics, he went through, in the first interview, he went through long stories about all the various jobs that he'd had, eventually coming around to how he came to run for alderman and lost the first time and then tried a second time and got elected. Didn't say anything about his first two races. As I talked to more people, they mentioned about this, these earlier Assembly races. I looked it up. I talked to Joe Czarnecki, who was his first opponent. And then I came back to him in the second interview and asked him about this, and he told me. And I said, well, you know, why didn't you mention this before? He said, well, you didn't ask me. And I said, well, I asked you how you got into politics, and I would think that you would tell me about your first two races before you got around to your third and fourth. And he didn't have a lot to say. But he admitted eventually that if people see you as a Republican in Milwaukee, that's a political liability. And so it is better for him to be seen as a nonpartisan, and he calls himself a nonpartisan. He has not been identified at all with the Republican Party since then.
Right. The Republican spokesman said he doesn't have any memory of Donovan showing up at any recent GOP
events.
No.
Well, not even recent, but in the last 20 years. And he, in fact, when I was talking to him, he said, well, you know, we don't really have a candidate to run against Barrett, but better to have a conservative Democrat than nobody. And when I told him that Donovan had run for office as Republican, he was quite surprised to hear that.
There are calls for him to run for mayor, even if he says he is not running at this point. What is it that some see in him that might make him a challenge for Tom Barrett?
What some people see in him is essentially the opposite of Mayor Barrett. That Mayor Barrett is, the rap on him has always been the idea that he's too nice of a guy. Donovan is somebody who's not afraid to shake things up. Mayor Barrett, obviously a Democrat towards the liberal side. Donovan, more conservative, even if he's not a Republican per se, he's certainly a conservative. Donovan, very strong on law and order issues. That's not to say that Barrett is not. Barrett would be the first to point out, you know, how much money he does put into the police department. But there's also this idea among some of the longtime residents, the idea that Bob Donovan would bring Milwaukee back to what it used to be like, you know, when they were growing up, when it was this clean, safe city. And, you know, whether you can truly turn the clock back, you know, who knows. But that's the idea.
Well, and there are some critics that say that's code for what it demographically used to look like. But at the same time, we should point out that Bob Donovan's district is largely Hispanic, and that has not stopped him from winning re-election.
That's true. He does have a Hispanic district, and in fact, that was a point of great controversy during the redistricting. The redistricting debate really in Milwaukee Common Council was all about Bob Donovan's district because he was trying to hold on to some predominantly white wards in the Jackson Park neighborhood where he grew up, which would have made his district a little less Hispanic, probably still like, you know, more than 50%, but you know, now it's over 60%. But he did get reelected nonetheless against a Hispanic opponent, actually against three Hispanic opponents in the primary. And some say that is because specifically of the approach to constituent service, because regardless of whether you're Hispanic or white or black or whatever, you know, you want your streetlights to work. You want your alderman to respond when you call, and he does.
You write that Bob Donovan's relationships with other council members are, I don't know, maybe strained at best.
Yes, indeed. And that is partly because of his style, which is that he will just go off and say what he wants without worrying about whether it offends people. But he doesn't really seem to want to make friends on the council. I mean, I asked him, do you socialize? Do you go out to lunch with people, other aldermen? And he said, no. You know, he has his own friends. He has his own family. That's who he prefers to spend his time with. And so much more so than any other alderman, he is isolated on the council, not just by his votes, because you know, there are a couple who will vote with him on at least some issues, sometimes most issues. But socially, you know, he's isolated. He doesn't play well with others, so to speak, at least in the council context. It's very difficult to find anybody on the council who has a lot of good things to say about him.
Your profile also points to some legal challenges in Donovan's past. He was one of a handful of aldermen indicted between 2002 and 2007, and then there's the much earlier 1992 arrest at UW-Milwaukee. Both of those cases seem like they're ancient history as far as his political career goes. So they're not really sticking to him in terms of his electability.
No. They haven't stuck to him. They've both been brought up in campaigns. In his first campaign, or I should say his second campaign for alderman in 2000, his opponent did bring up the question of his arrest in a Peeping Tom arrest, basically, in a men's room in UWM. That did not stop him from getting elected that first time. And then in 2004, his opponent at that time raised questions about his relationship with an organization that he had founded called the Milwaukee Alliance, that he had then voted for community development block grants for. That did not stop him from getting reelected in 2004. It did wind up turning into an indictment in 2005, but then that charge was eventually dismissed after evidence came out that he had talked to the ethics board about the potential conflicts there. He did wind up paying what the prosecutor called a fine. He says it was just to reimburse the city for its investigation cost, but it was $2,500 any way you slice it. And he had certain restrictions that he agreed to about not working with community groups. But nonetheless, despite all that, he had no opponent in 2008. So these things are either not important to his constituents or are not important enough to override what they see as the things that they like about him.
Now, late in the article, you reference the shooting of a black teenager in his aldermanic district by a man who had just vented his complaints to Donovan and then went home and shot this teen. Why did you see that as a relevant story for this profile?
Well, and in fact, it actually was in the district right next to his in
My
Alderman
mistake,
Perez's
yeah.
district. But what was relevant about that was this was an example of how people feel that they can just come and talk Bob Donovan. And he has this hangout at George Webb's at 21st and Mitchell that's almost like a district office for him, where people come and talk to him and meet with him, either arranged or spontaneous. And this was one of those people who he had met. It's part of his sort of connection to the neighborhood is that he goes every day for coffee at this particular George Webb's. And he says, you know, this guy, John Spooner, was somebody who he didn't really know. He knew by first name only, had seen him in George Webb's, had talked to him occasionally. And Spooner came and vented to him about how angry he was that the police had not investigated his missing guns. And he made the comment, there are other ways to handle these things. As we all know, he went home and confronted his 13-year-old neighbor, black youth by the name of Darius Simmons, and shot him, dead, which was a very tragic story. It said something, and Donovan wound up testifying in that trial, but it said something about the kind of the racial tensions that you see in changing neighborhoods, and I linked that up with the redistricting issues. And also, you know, there had been another incident previously where Alderman Donovan and Alderman Dudzik had issued a statement about the violence at State Fair a few years ago. There was a very controversial statement that talked about a deteriorating African-American culture. And this is important to look at in this context because Donovan's support is in the white community, and ultimately his relationship with the minority communities, if he did make a citywide race, that would play into it very much so. Question of whether he would get any support either from Hispanics or from African Americans.
So at the end of the day, do you feel like you have more insight into the man than when you started?
I do. And I speak from the standpoint of having covered him for 5 years as the City Hall reporter at the Journal Sentinel and on a variety of other stories before and since. But yeah, I did feel that after spending all that time with him, I did get a little more insight into him.
Larry Sandler, thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Larry Sandler's article on Milwaukee Alderman Bob Donovan is called Lone Wolf, and it's in the November issue of Milwaukee Magazine, which is set to hit a newsstand near you. A short break now, and then we'll look back at 30 years of business news in Milwaukee, condensed to about 10 minutes. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Milwaukee's downtown is a hodgepodge of architecture. There are plenty of historic buildings here, but many new ones as well that have sprouted in the last three decades. And that cityscape is a pretty good metaphor for the Milwaukee business community at large. It was 30 years ago that the Business Journal of Milwaukee printed its first issue. This week's issue looks back at the past 30 years and ahead to what could be in its pages in the three decades ahead. Mark Sabeljack is publisher of the Business Journal. Mark Cass is the editor, and they're with us now. Welcome to Lake Effect.
It's always good to be here, Mitch.
Thank you, Mitch.
Paint a picture of what Milwaukee was like 30 years ago as the Business Journal first went to press.
I mean, it's really interesting, Mitch. As I look back over the first few issues, a lot of the issues that were happening then are actually happening today still. I mean, there was talk about the Bucks and terms of a lease at the old arena. There was healthcare issues. There was real estate questions. There was a lot of issues on the lakefront. So a lot of things kind of happened. But it was also interesting to see how the community has changed. If you think about even our skyline, I mean, back in 83, obviously a majority of the buildings on both Wisconsin Avenue and on Water Street, in terms of 100 East, 1,000 Water, and all that actually weren't there. I mean, you obviously have the Grand Avenue opened in 83. So, and it was kind of the big thing at that time. So really a lot of things have happened over the past 30 years to really help this community. But I think it was interesting to see how it kind of changed over time, too. You had some ups and downs. You had, you know, the 80s and early 90s where things were really good, kind of a lull in the mid-90s in terms of real estate, and then up and then down again over the past few years. So it's really been a change.
And 30 years ago, this is before the renaissance of the Third Ward.
Correct.
Third Ward
and
was
the stadium. Think of that, too. We had, you know, we obviously had County Stadium at that time. It was obviously a big thing. The Third Ward, how about the residential? Think back to the early 80s, early mid-80s. Not a lot of people lived in the heart of the city. Now it's a big deal.
I think, Mitch, that's perhaps one of the biggest things is our downtown weathered well and actually in the last 30 years really has come alive. I started listening to an audiobook yesterday about Detroit and its downfall and, you know, therefore the grace of God, a lot of it as you listen to it. But I think we're, you know, we're in a good situation poised for really doing a lot with not just the downtown area, but, you know, both north and south as the third and fifth ward continue to grow.
I was just going to say, it's also interesting kind of as you look at things that have happened over the 30 years. Think about our airport. And, you know, the early 80s is when Midwest Airlines started and grew to become everybody's favorite airline. It went down. It got bought by Frontier, had the big hostile takeover attempts. Huge news. Now it's gone. So in 30 years, in essence, we had an airline grow and go away.
30 years is actually a really pretty interesting sample. It has been a pretty eventful three decades. What would you say, I mean, aside from, for example, the rise and fall of Midwest, as you looked back over 30 years worth of business journals, what were the key stories that rose to the top over those times?
There's the Harley story. Think about the leverage buyout in the early 80s. And the rise of Harley, and it became, you know, obviously the 100th anniversary of the shooting thing. And then in that 10 years between the 100 and 110th was quite a 10 years for Harley. I mean, they really had some issues and they really changed. So Harley was a huge story. You think of Miller Brewing. You know, in the 80s, it was a huge thing. They got bought, obviously not bought. They did a merger with Coors. Now it's Miller Coors. You think about First Star Bank and U.S. Bank in terms of merger there. Who even knew in 83 about Aurora Healthcare? Aurora Healthcare wasn't even around. Now they're our largest employer in the state. You know, so there's been a lot of things that have changed, a lot of stories that have come and gone. You got the whole story of Miller Park, you know, obviously was built. You got the whole story of the Menominee Valley. One of the most interesting things I found in the one of our first editorials in our paper came out in support of a prison in the Menominee Valley. I don't know if everybody remembers that, but Henry Meyer actually talked about having a prison in the valley. Think about how that would have changed our community about, you know, having that there. I mean, so there have been so many interesting things happen over the past three decades.
I'm curious, what was the top story in the paper in that first issue of the Business
Journal? It was actually a sale of an office building in downtown. It was for Plaza East. And a front page feature on hernia movers.
If
you read our paper this week, you'll see an update on hernia movers who are still in business. So that's kind of fun to see that.
Look back over those 30 years. Who were the key players you saw emerging on the scene? I mean, if you wanted to do a best of the last 30 years, who were the business leaders that you point to?
Well, there's probably five or six that everybody talks about. I think probably number one that I've heard from a lot of people is actually Mike Cudahy. If you think about his impact on this community through business first with Marquette Electronics, then to all of his work with the Art Museum, to his work with Discovery World and Harbor House. He was probably number one on the list. Then you had people like Gary Gruno, obviously, Mayor Norquist. you know, people like Mary Ellen Stanek at Baird, who kind of been one of the few females who have been one of our key leaders in the community. You have Catherine Hudson, who was the head of Brady, the only female head of a company in our area, of a large company. You have Lou Bars, who had a significant impact on the area. There are so many people who really had an impact, but those are probably the few who have stood out.
You mentioned that at the time there was only one woman leader of a company
of that size.
One of the things that the Business Journal has done over the past 30 years is spotlight women leaders.
Right.
And do you find yourself sort of right in the middle of the transformation of business leadership in Milwaukee in that way?
Well, I don't know if it's transforming fast enough for anyone. In fact, we held a get-together a couple of weeks ago with women business leaders in the area, and I think you'd be still hard-pressed to find women at the top of organizations other than perhaps in the nonprofit sector. So I think there's a long way to go. I do think Milwaukee has changed, though, in the 30 years, some of it out of necessity. As Mark said, there's been a significant number of companies that have been taken over here, merged, headquarters moved out. So we have a lot less leaders than we had in the 70s and 80s who live here, work here, and stay here. And as a result, we've had to become a more welcoming community. And I think that to some degree, those individuals that have moved into the area, who in the past have always complained that it's taken a while for them to integrate into leadership, they're moving up quicker. Women and young professionals, individuals of color, have more opportunity. But I don't think any of those groups is going to feel like they've made the progress that they want to make. We're going to need them as we start talking about the next 30 years. And part of what this issue about is to say, what do we expect to see in the next 30 years? We need those individuals badly to move up into the ranks and provide leadership.
I mean, I agree with that. I also think one of the things he brought up, which is important, was the whole headquarters issue. If you think back over the past three decades, how many headquarters have left the city and how that's impacted us. Some of the bigger ones have been Miller Coors, now out of Chicago. You know, the whole Midwest Airlines obviously isn't here. You have Bucyrus. And then there's quite a few firms that are gone, and Alice Chalmers. You know, A.O. Smith is still a company but doesn't have nearly as huge of an employment base, obviously, as it had here back then. And you know, really a lot of firms have changed. And it's really kind of switched our identity. And you're seeing it now through the whole issue of water, that maybe as that's our next thing over the next three decades will be our image in a sense.
Well, and you mentioned the leaders that emerged on the scene over the past three decades. Are there business professionals, young ones who are rising up through the ranks that you would expect when you're doing this issue 30 years from now are going to be featured at that point?
There is. I think what we've seen over the past 3 to 4 years is kind of a real good energy around the young professionals in our community. And there are people who are out there through Milwaukee, through Art Milwaukee, through some of these startups, through entrepreneurs, through an Andy Nunnemaker, and you know, all those people who are out there who have really good ideas and who are active. And I can think back, 5, 8 years, and that just I don't think it was there. And I think there's a new generation that's out there. Are they in the leadership yet? No. But they're active and they're making waves and they're creating friends. I think our community's in a much better spot than it was maybe 3 to 5 years ago.
They're at the table, Mitch, I think, for the first time. And I think that there's enlightened leadership in Milwaukee, older leadership that is including them in the decision-making, not just in a junior rank or in the second row of the decision-making, but they're actually putting them at the table. And as a result, you know, they're showing their chops. And I think you're going to see those individuals mentor other young professionals. And I think we're going to really have a nice mix in the very, very near future.
What about changes in business news reporting? How has the way the Business Journal itself reported on business news, how has it changed over the past three decades? Obviously, the internet was
right.
Not there.
I was going to say, it's fascinating. I tell the story all the time. I've been at the Business Journal on and off for 18 years. Obviously, I was there before that as a reporter in 1989, and our paper had no website. So all our reporters did, and I say all kind of in quotes, was we worked on the newspaper every week. Nowadays, I have an editor on my staff who does basically 100% web. I have all my reporters who spend a lot of time on the web. I mean the web has really switched our business. I mean, kind of as you know, news happens now. I mean, I always use the example of when the woman from Koss, who allegedly, and I always use that in quotes, stole all that money the day that she was in court to go to jail. I had a reporter in the courtroom. You know, he found out it was 11 years. He sent me an email. Quickly, I had in the story email blast out to our readers. Our email subscribers knew about that within 3 minutes of it happening. I mean, think back in 83, you had to wait for your evening news. You had to wait for your newspaper the next day. So news happens. So we've had to adjust, and I think we've adjusted well. But I think all media kind of has had to learn that news happens fast, and you have to let your readers know. But I think where our paper has kind of been maybe a little bit different is we always try to provide the analysis and the context. I mean, how does it impact you as a reader? I always ask my reporters about – I say, why should I care?
The analysis and the context, I would imagine, were easier to do when it was simply a once-a-week exercise. It has to come a lot faster now that news is an all-the-time sort of enterprise.
It has to come faster, but I also think it's more fun. I mean, you have so many more opportunities now to have your name out there, to have the story out there. I mean, we used to put our paper to bed on Wednesday and hope and pray that our story wouldn't end up in another newspaper in town before it came out. Now I can have it on the web very quickly. So it's changed. It's fun. I think there's more opportunities for any paper, but I think our paper especially, to stand out because of the context.
There's a redesign in the works, I understand correctly. You probably don't want to give away what it's going to look like, but give me the story of what's going to change.
Our company, which owns 40 print publications and is also in three additional markets, decided a couple years ago that they wanted to freshen the print. They wanted the print to look and work with the digital online material. So the designer spent a year with us. We did focus groups throughout the country. And throughout this year and early next year, we're rolling out this redesign. It's a commitment to print. It shows that we expect print to be alive and kicking for a long, long time, against odds probably, but we're going to do it. And it also gives us an opportunity really to look at all of our content. We've done local focus groups. There's going to be some of our material that's going to be continue to be included and highlighted, but also some new material that we think will help explain what the news is all about. And that's really where the print edition takes on a role. As we break the news digitally on Friday, we'll explain a little bit the story behind the story. And as Mark said, why should you care?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a fun, exciting time for us at least in that, you know, we've been able to be on the web, very active on the web, but still have a print product that everyone wants to read on Friday. And I think there are a lot of people out there who still like to read print. And it's funny, and it's not young or old. I have people I know who are very young who read our paper every week, every page. Some of the older people that I know maybe who don't, who actually look online for it. So it's just, you know, you have to have both. You have to have strong in both. And you really, I think, have to provide an opportunity for people to interact with you. And I think that's what we'll do. And it'll be fun. It's, you know, everybody asks about our industry. Is it going away? Is it that? You know, I don't think it is. I think it's going to be different and stronger and better in the long run.
Well, we'll be looking for it.
All right, Mitch, I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mitch.
Mark Cass is editor and Mark Sabeljack, publisher of the Business Journal of Milwaukee. The paper's 30th anniversary edition is out today. You'll find a link to more from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. Another break, and Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. The power of Wisconsin towns and counties to regulate things like mining, blasting, and road construction has been a hot topic of debate this week, especially yesterday as a state Senate committee spent hours in a Capitol conference room taking public comment on a bill. Authors of the bill say it'll eliminate a hodgepodge of local ordinances that bog down Wisconsin's burgeoning frack sand mining industry and pave the way for more jobs in the state. Critics, though, decry what they see as sweeping measures that strip local governments of so-called police powers and leave them with limited zoning authority. Two UWM professors, one a biologist, the other a conflict resolution specialist, say the situation is emblematic of a larger issue in state government. Tim Ellinger, the scientist, and Robert Sigliano are creating a new master's degree program at UWM in sustainable peacebuilding. They sat down with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Benson, shared their take on what's going on in the state legislature. Ellinger says people around the world are concerned about whether they're being heard by their elected officials.
This really, in my experience, hits sort of a critical sort of friction surface when you have an issue like we're seeing here with mining, issues with water, where you have sort of large issues on a state or national or regional scale dealing either with jobs or economic development, and then local well-being, things that the local people want. And we see this over and over again in Wisconsin. We see it in places like Romania on short and long-term scales. In the United States, we kind of balance this with legislation as part of our National Environmental Protection Act, or NEPA as it's called, because when we were building the interstate highways, there were a lot of these types of problems where the federal government had plans for highways, but local communities, they didn't feel like they were being asked at where these highways would go. So the whole NEPA was established as a way of protecting individual concerns when you have sort of larger scale projects going on. And as part of NEPA, they established these procedures that would have sort of local input, that would balance economic issues, social issues, environmental issues, and then integrate those local concerns with sort of the national and state regulations. So many of the processes that go through in terms of permitting mines, permitting wells, have this legacy that's carried over from the National Environmental Protection Act. But where I see much of the tension occurring is that historically, the federal law has always deferred to lower levels that allow them to be more protective of ecosystem goods and services and local rights than the national law. We've seen this with the Clean Water Act. We see it with zoning ordinances. Basically, once you meet the federal regulations or the state regulations, you have the opportunity to raise that higher given the local communities' concerns. So your local concerns trump state or national, as long, again, as you're meeting the protective requirements of NEPA. What seems to be happening here is that's being reversed in a way that the state needs for economic growth or development are taking precedence over the local concerns. Now, whether that should or should not occur is not really what I'm talking about here, but what needs to happen is there needs to be this process by which the local community has the opportunity to engage in the discussion so that as the process moves through legislative approval, through permitting, that all of these issues get brought up, discussed, incorporated into the final determination. The legislation, for example, the Tiffany legislation and other legislation with mining, the pressure that they are trying to deal with is that NEPA and this process is messy, just as democracy is messy. And it's difficult for businesses, it's difficult for investors to work their way through this process without greater regulatory certainty. And that's the driving force, in my mind, behind some of this legislation, because the investors have quarterly profit reports of investors that they need to be able to report to. And it's difficult to continually have to go back to responding to the local concerns, the community desires for well-being and protection, and balancing those. But that's the basis upon which a democratic republic is founded. There has to be this accountability at the state level. And by short-circuiting that, I think we really are short-circuiting a trust relationship upon which our government is founded.
Yeah, I mean, internationally, you see almost the defining characteristic in many conflicts are local communities that feel marginalized. And usually we see these in places where they've never really had a strong tradition of national level, local level, regional level politics, representative democracy, the history that we sort of take for granted here. So we're not necessarily surprised when we see that in countries that are in transition or have been in transition more or less from, say, colonial times or newly independent states. There is a common root, which is it's the inability to deal with conflict over some basic and very important issues. And so the tendency is to want to sort of short-circuit that and say, well, rather than investing in all this work with local communities that might be very time-consuming, and there's no guarantee that'll make things better. In fact, it may make things much worse. So why go through that? And why don't we just sort of kind of rewrite the rules? Whereas local communities say, but wait a minute, those aren't our rules. You're changing them. And it's not what we've grown up with. It's not what we expect. I mean, the bottom line is there really is no substitute to actually being able to sit down and work through a lot of these issues. And the really dangerous phenomenon that I think we're seeing is that we're seeing lots of disputes over various pieces of legislation or various projects. And how we're handling each dispute is actually tending to make the underlying drivers of those disputes worse. So the level of trust that communities have in their elected officials, in private interests and their impact on the political process through funding or lobbying or whatever it may be. However, you know, we resolve any of these particular issues, there'll be winners and losers in that. And we all tend to lose if the underlying drivers of these conflicts get worse, if those underlying relationships get worse, and our ability to handle future disputes degrades, gets worse. And that's the hard part that we really need to keep our eyes on, is how are people actually talking about any of these issues? Is the rhetoric getting worse? One of the chief ingredients that negotiators, professional negotiators, even people that do hostage negotiations, will tell you is that one of the key ways you influence people and you work toward commonly acceptable solutions is having empathy for the other side. So one thing to look for is, are we seeing empathy here? Does either side have empathy toward what the other side might actually be thinking?
I can give a local example of that from my experience in the conflict between what was then the town of Mount Pleasant and the DNR over a flood control project recently in Mount Pleasant, where the town had prepared a flood control project because of the very serious concerns that they had there. But the initial application was denied by the state because it did not meet certain types of environmental requirements. And they were ready to go to the Supreme Court, take it to court, when they entered a facilitation process where the farmers were able to explain to the state agency that they needed to develop these fields to provide retirement funds for them, that the village needed to be able to develop in such a way that promoted the stability of their tax base, but at the same time where the state was able to express that they have larger concerns related to protecting the public trust in the waterways and protecting the environment. And that discussion, it took time, but eventually what came out of the project was a corridor restoration project that has been a showcase of a collaboration between local communities and state regulations that has now become the Pike River Corridor Restoration Project, award-winning project just down the road here. Through, again, the sharing of what Rob was saying, getting into that shared understanding and empathy for each other's positions.
So just thinking of this particular piece of legislation.
Well, each of these issues is in their own right important, but I often talk about the dynamic where people treat the symptom as the patient. So this piece of legislation the patient, in other words, the thing we need to resolve and that will handle this problem, or is it a symptom of a deeper problem? And I think it's clearly a symptom of a deeper problem, even though it is important. We have to both think about how do we work through this particular issue and engage on these deeper problems. And in fact, maybe producing a better way of engaging on these deeper problems would actually make resolution to this piece of legislation go away.
But we have to also recognize that when we're looking at these complex problems, we really have three very interacting but distinct systems going on. We have the environmental, physical, geochemical systems of water and land and minerals that kind of work together in a scientific way. And if you have an impact in one location, it's going to move to another location, whether you're a farmer living next to a mine or a community living next to a sand pit. But you also have the social value systems, when you may have Native Americans with values that are different than the local farmers or the hunters. So you have those value systems that have to be negotiated. And then in this case, you have the legislative, the institutional system, because here you have the complexity of non-government organizations. You have individuals. You have businesses. You have governmental entities that exist at the state, the national, and the local level. And the way those different groups work together, that complexity is really going to be there all the time. All those groups are going to have to continue to work together. And if you lose that communication, if you lose that trust, if you demonize one part of that system, this is not going to be able to come to resolutions and work effectively or adapt to changes that are going to inevitably going to go on. It's the sense of resilience and how are we going to respond to the next economic crisis? How are we going to respond to the next climate crisis? How are we going to respond to the next health crisis? We have to be able to work together to deal with these unpredictable parts of our lives.
Tim Ellinger and Rob Rosigliano are developing the Masters of Sustainable Peacebuilding program at UW-Milwaukee. They spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. One last break, and then we'll meet the leader at the helm of Wisconsin's largest nonprofit music school. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. It's been a little over half a year since Gregory Ruffer was named to lead the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music. The institution is the oldest and largest nonprofit music school in the state. Ruffer came from two positions at the Straz Center for the Performing Arts in Tampa, Florida, with a background in both vocal music and youth orchestra. Lake Effect's Bonnie North sat down with Ruffer after he had been on the job for a few months, and he reflected on the transition and what drew him to the Wisconsin Conservatory.
Well, part of it has to do with just there's a trajectory in my life that I've gone from being a school teacher up through a department chair, and the next step really was to running the conservatory. So I was looking for positions like this. But when I started to research Milwaukee, it's just full of surprises. For someone who's – I was grew up in Ohio and I've lived in D.C. and New York and Florida, I had never thought about Milwaukee as a place to go. And so I looked at the job and thought, this job looks really interesting. I think the conservatory looks interesting. So I started doing my online research on Milwaukee and found that this place was so rich in culture and there were so many things happening in music and theater and having a ballet company and honestly, WUWM, since I've been here, I really enjoy. So there's so many things that are happening here that I felt this could really feel like home. And the last 13 years I've been in Florida. And for someone who has been a visitor there, they'll say, oh, how could you ever leave? It's such beautiful weather. And yes, it is. It's a lovely place to live. It is not necessarily a lovely place for an artist to live. So arts in Florida often struggle. So much of the economy is based on service economy for people who are working in theme parks or in tourism. So they don't necessarily have disposable income to be in the arts. And Northerners often have a stronger value on the arts is because it's a part of the education system. It's a part of the churches that are up here. So I was looking forward to getting back north again.
When you looked at what the conservatory offered and how it offered it, was there something that stood out for you in the way music education was presented to the students? And the thing that I like about the conservatory particularly is that it's a lot of kids, but it's also a lot of adults.
It is. And it's for everybody. It's not just for those people who are really on the verge of becoming the next professional musician, but they're for little guys who are a year old or 3 years old who want to get their first experiences. It's for people who are using our music therapy program to help them work through some of the challenges that they have in life. It's also for adults who once did something in their youth and maybe got away from it through college or through their first part of their work experience and said, I want to come back and play piano again. We have something for everybody, as well as that really high level of instruction for those kids who say, music is something I want to do for a living. So I like that. I like the breadth of it. I love that I can go and listen to an amazing jazz program that we have, as well as listening to singers of all styles. And where my office is, I often hear trombone player above me and a saxophone player below me. And that kind of cacophony is something I'd love to hear.
How do you manage such a diverse thing, though? The breadth is great, but as the president, how do you focus the mission?
That's probably the biggest challenge. Because when you have a large offering of things, coming in and finding that one place where you can say this is the core of what it is we do is a little bit more difficult. Now, I can say from my background, I have a bachelor's degree in music education with an emphasis in saxophone and a master's degree in conducting and voice. And my doctoral work is all in college music teaching. So I have done vocal and instrumental work. I've conducted professional orchestras. I've worked with kids. So I have enough experience in all the areas of what we do to to be dangerous, I guess, in some of it. But it's also a way for me to say, I see how all these things fit into the bigger picture of music. It's not just because I most recently came from conducting choirs and doing opera that my only focus is on singing. And I think that core mission is really about how we are a part of the community here in Milwaukee and enhance life in this part of Wisconsin.
So what do you think the conservatory was doing really well when you arrived? And what would you like to improve now that you've gotten your feet a little wet?
I think they were doing really well with the level of instruction that we have, that hiring really the best qualified and the best people in town. They are part of our faculty. We've also done very well in communicating and working with the Milwaukee Public Schools and some of the other school offerings here, private schools and charter schools, where we work side by side with their music departments to offer what we call band buddies, which somebody in the schools can go out and help a child along that the band director can't necessarily get to everybody. We are able to offer a program where the school isn't able to at all. So they bring us in and we do a general music program, or we do a drumming program or something along that line. Those are things that I think were done very, very well. What I would like to see us do is even more integration into the community, where we're working hand in hand with the MSO, with Florentine Opera, with some of the other arts organizations, so we are able to enhance what they do and find other educational outlets.
So do you think that education in that broader sense remains the main focus? It's not performance necessarily?
No, okay. Absolutely. I am completely committed to everything we do has to be educational, that our performance is part of our education. Just last week we had a jazz camp, and at the end of the camp the kids did a performance and I was thrilled with it. And what was interesting as I was talking to the instructors and other staff members is that where I was thrilled was not what they were expecting. They thought I was thrilled because of the level of performance. What I was excited about was what I saw pedagogically happening, that kids were being taught in a sequential manner and allowed to expand on those things that they can do into areas where they were just getting their feet wet. So they maybe were doing some improvisation, not the way they're going to do it in 2 years, but fearlessly doing it. And that's education to me. So the performance was amazing because I saw them displaying what it is they're learning.
And taking risks. It sounds like people are being set up to be able to take risks.
Oh, absolutely. And they're encouraged to do that. So we've created this atmosphere where kids feel nurtured, where adults feel nurtured, and they can go out on a limb, try something different, and not feel like somebody's judging them for it. But it's just their place to be expressing themselves.
How is the funding going? I mean, we've just come out of a recession, and a lot of places we aren't out of a recession yet. I'm hearing, you know, bits and pieces that things are picking up in general. Are you finding that donations are up? Are you finding grants easier to come by?
I haven't really been there long enough to say I have a history with that. I can say that a big portion of my job is fundraising and finding new revenue streams for the conservatory. I believe that things are looking up, and from what I hear, my board members are well connected into the community to know who is doing well in one area or another, and so they help to direct us that way. But it is a challenge, and I think, you know, if there's listeners out there that want to drop us a check, we certainly won't say no. But we are in a place where we offer so much to the community that I think if we continue to focus on what it is we do for the community, what it is we do for the individuals, that the funding behind that will show up, because we're staying true to our mission. We're staying true to the area.
As you're looking ahead at what you'd like to do, if money were no object, what are some of the programs you'd like to put into place?
Well, I think that we are looking toward more classical music. We have this amazing jazz program that's very large and well-funded through the Batterman Foundation. But we have areas where we could be offering more in, say, our string programs or in our wind programs. I would also love to see us offering more vocal music that we have. I've spoken with Florentine Opera and with Skylight Music Theater to know what their programs are. So I'm looking at, are there ways that we can create something that helps to feed those future artists that are coming through there, as well as bring in audiences from their places to learn about some of the things that they're doing? I think there's a synergy there that we can be doing. There's so many possibilities for partnerships and working together with other arts organizations that I think I'm just in the discovery end of that right now. If I look at what I think I want to do into the future, it has to do with collaboration. And where those collaborations take us are just opening up every day.
A lot of arts organizations already have educational outreach as part of their mission. Mm-hmm. You know, most of the nonprofits do, or they have an education coordinator. How do you see working with them without, like, stepping on each other's toes, you know, and keeping to your mission but also enhancing maybe what they're doing as well?
Well, I don't see anyone as a competitor. So inside the city, we have a number of other people who are offering musical experiences for kids, and I don't see that as competition. When we live in an area, I would say we're in our metro area, we're well over a million people. Our 1,300 people that we're serving are not going to step on the toes of someone else. But the other part of it is meeting together to find out what it is that's important to the mission of another organization, what it is that's important to us, and how do those two meet at some point. Whether it's we take on the younger end of training students, send them off to another organization as they get to school age, and then bring them back in when they're older on our end, maybe that's the way we work together. Maybe it's offering programs for education so that someone who wants to go to see the symphony has a place to go prior to it that becomes a sort of a coffee clatch, a club of sorts, that they can sit down and chat with someone about what they're going to see at the symphony, so then they buy a ticket to go on to the symphony. I think that we have many, many opportunities that way.
And it also sounds like, I hate the phrase thinking outside the box, but it sounds like trying to find new ways of making those connections that that maybe haven't been thought of before.
Mm-hmm. And I like the idea of discovering what it is other people are looking for. There are a number of us in town who are fairly new to our positions in as I talk with other people, I find that they're hungry for the same type of thing, that they want to find where is their niche in the community and how can they do what it is they do and still connect with other organizations, other people. I don't see Milwaukee as a competitive area. I see everybody playing together really very nicely.
Well, Greg, I want to welcome you first, you know, formally to Milwaukee. And
thanks
so much for coming on the show. And I look forward to talking to you in the years to come.
Thank you very much. I'm enjoying this.
Greg Ruffer is the president and CEO of the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music. He came to the job this past March after 13 years working in various arts organizations in Florida. That's Friday's edition of Lake Effect. We are produced, as we always are, by the crack team of Dan Harmon, Stephanie Lecce, and Bonnie North, with the able assistance of Nathan Royster and Eleanor Peterson. John Strelecki is our studio engineer. I'm Mitch Teich. It's so great to have you listening this week, as it is every week. Hope you can make us part of your weekend as well. We're on with Lake Effect Weekend, Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3, and then right back here at 10 o'clock Monday morning. It's Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock. Have a great weekend.